I've actually been involved in teaching AP for about 60 years, so I beat you, John. But to go back to Selmus, I came back to England in 1975 to do a master's degree at Essex University, where I met Steve and Joe McDonough, who were working in providing English language service English for overseas students in the university. It's interesting that on that MA course that I was on, at least five people are now still involved in EAP around the world. So it was quite a significant time. When I had finished at Essex, I moved to Aston University in 77. There I was appointed just to teach EAP. It was 3 years before we got the MSc going. Now, I was working with someone called Kath Johns, now Kath Johns Lewis, who was married to Tim Johns at Birmingham, that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of, who was started one of the biggest programs in EAP in Britain at Birmingham University. And he was one of the founder members of Selmus in 1972. I went to my first Selmus meeting in 1975 when I was taken by Jo McDonough, because she knew I was working on a book for Africa, which was called Reading for a Purpose. That book was for upper secondary schools originally in Nigeria and was then used all over southern Africa. It was published by Macmillan but was never available in Britain, although it was essentially early EAP. It was designed to encourage secondary school students to read in the fields of study that they were working in and to approach reading from a point of view of trying to find out things and reading for specific reasons. And that was a series of books. I did book three. Neville Grant worked on book one and book two. And we had African colleagues that were helping us with those books. I don't know whether they're still used in Africa. I haven't seen a copy for donkey's years, but it was essentially early EAP, which Jo saw, and she invited me to come along to Selmus. At that first meeting of Selmus I went to, there were fewer than 10 people. I've tried to list the people that were there, and I think I remember correctly that there was Keith Johnson, Bob Jordan, Brian Heaton, Tim Johns, Catherine Johns, Joe McDonough, and Steve McDonough. Maybe John Holmes was there, because he was also at Essex at the same time, and David Hall, who is now at Macquarie University. Coming to England in the 1970s was quite interesting, because if you're looking at the development of EAP, you have to think of the whole educational scene. For one thing, England was a technological desert in 1975. It's very difficult for people nowadays to imagine just what it was like. For example, well, you know, there were no mobile phones, there were no computers, there were no videos, there were none of the things that we just take for granted nowadays. In Botswana, I had worked in a training college for government officials and people employed by the government in Botswana. And there we had a film studio with a 16mm film projector and films provided by the British Council. We also had a dedicated English language classroom with an overhead projector in it when I went to Aston in 77, you could get an overhead projector, but only if you ordered it at least a week in advance, and it wasn't needed by somebody else in the university. It was delivered to your room for a particular lecture. We didn't have any photocopying facilities, except for the cyclostyling machine. That's right, I see somebody turning his hand, so you may remember that. So it was a very, very different world. But although when I went to a Selmers meeting, what happened was that the 10 people who were usually there came along with samples of materials that they'd written themselves and typed out, and maybe cyclostyled copies, and we passed them round and we discussed them, and we compared them with what we'd been doing in class, and we chatted about how you might use them, and it was a very, very different world, I can tell you, a very different world. But although it was a technological desert, the 1970s in England was a sort of hotbed of linguistic fever. Because what had happened was that in the 50s, I think probably John could correct me about when, the first diploma in applied linguistics had started at Edinburgh University and then at Leeds University. There were people talking about the importance of language training, of text analysis, of linguistics in general, and how it could be used in education. And the master's courses were starting in the 1970s. I selected Essex as a place to go because Essex had already reached some fame because Peter Strevens was professor there. Actually, he left by the time I got there, but he was a professor when I applied, and he had written, I'd seen a distributed copy of the article, but it was not actually published until 1971, a very important paper called Alternatives to Daffodils, which he based on his experiences in Africa, where he found that in the secondary schools where students really needed language for their academic purposes, they were learning I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud and all sorts of very culturally specific English literature courses. There was a big report that came out of West Africa called the Grieve Report, which I've tried to trace recently, but I can't get hold of a copy of it, which was a report on the West African results in the English school certificate examinations. And it was a challenge to say that really English school certificate was inappropriate for the kind of English courses that were needed in Africa at that time, and that was also very important. Over in Chile, Ewa and Latour were working on teaching scientific English. All around the world, in Washington, as John's already mentioned, and Michigan, I believe, there were Americans who were working on academic English and beginning to publish. Although Chomsky had already sort of come like a big flash in the pan into American linguistics, in Britain there was still masses of descriptive and functional linguistics going on. Palladian linguistics, systemic functional linguistics, as we now call it, was being taught, and there were conferences on SFL in the 1970s, which were very, very influential. And that was also very exciting because it seemed as though it was something that would be very applicable to education. And I think what happened was that to some extent the linguistic fervor died out, partly because Chomsky and linguistics, transformational grammar, very narrow diachronic syntax, non-functional linguistics became taught in the universities. But functional linguistics did survive. It kept on going, particularly descriptive linguistics. And I think that was very valuable, and it led into a lot of the publications. There was this very amazing publication wasn't actually published until 1981, but pretty well everything in it was written in the 1970s, which was Sally Pitarone and Tanzelli, English for Academic and Technical Purposes from the University of Washington, in which John had a paper, and many of the people who had known in EAP had articles. And that a lot of that work was concerned with what we called sort of grammatical rhetorical dependencies, the relationship between the grammar, the lexis, and the use to which those forms were put in language. The sort of thing that we heard in the plenary this morning from Caroline Coffin. I also remember very strongly that at that time systemic functional linguistics was very much more ethnographic, which Caroline Coffin was talking about today. Because, of course, one of the major influences on Holliday was Malinowski, who was an ethnographer and who first, I think, was the first person, in modern times anyway, to really look at the way the meaning of utterances was completely governed by the context in which it was used. And looking at things like Fatih Camuni and language in particular, workplaces and so on. I'm going on, I'm talking too much. So this is all before Balik started, really. I'm just trying to give you a picture of what it was like in the 1970s. There were very few people working. Salmas was set up, and as Andy has already mentioned, Salmas was a closed shop. Now, I had completely forgotten this. But 2 weeks ago, I was at Tony Dudley Evans' 70th birthday party. And Tony Dudley Evans was a big EAP, ESP person at Birmingham University, who wrote a book on ESP, which some of you may have read. And he now works almost entirely with jazz. But at his birthday party, I met Maggie Jo St. John, who was also at Aston in the 1970s. Well, in fact, we taught her, didn't we? She was a student first, and then she taught one of our best students. And a woman named Joanna Channel, who worked at Nottingham at one time. Some of you may know her. Anybody know Joanna Channel? Yeah. And I was talking, and they said, I hear you're going to be at Balik next week, and I said yes. And Joanna Channel and Maggie Jo then told me about what happened when they tried to go to a Selmas meeting, when they tried to join Selmas. And I'd completely forgotten all about this. And she said, we went along to the meeting, and they said, you'll have to wait outside while we discuss whether you are suitable to be admitted as a member of Selmas. And they had to go wait in another room, and we had a meeting. And I can't remember this meeting. And she said after about half an hour, someone came out and said, and they thought it was Tim Johns, but they weren't absolutely sure, and said, yes, we are pleased to welcome you as members of Selmas. And this seems so strange now that it could ever happen, really, but apparently it did happen. And so I looked back in some of the documents to see what kind of criteria we had for admitting people, if this had been discussed or written down anywhere. And I did find some notes, which, as Andy said, they must be teaching overseas students in a British university. They had to be. Now, in fact, we waived that in the case of, I can't remember whether it was Joanna, one of those two people said they weren't actually teaching at that time, but they were applying for jobs. They had to be appropriately qualified. That is, they had to know something about linguistics and education, and they had to be really keen. I noticed that really keen was sort of underlined, and interested in the students, and preferably had overseas experience. And I would like to make the point that very much all the way through, from Selmers to Bali to now, I think, EAP was an international project. Most of the people who started EAP in Britain got involved because there were increasing numbers of overseas students coming into the country and because they did need support. And most of those people had been involved in EAP somewhere else around the world. And these were the people that were here, and probably lots of you here today have overseas experience as well. And a lot of the countries around the world, I mean, we've already mentioned Finland, Indonesia, Malaysia, have been mentioned at this conference, most of China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Latin America, all these places, EAP is going on and is still going on, and a lot of the major work in EAP is going on there. And so it must remain an international project. I think EAP has to be an international project, a linguistic project, and an educational project. I think I'm probably running out of time. Have I got time to say something about the Bali accreditation scheme? Okay, since Andy mentioned it, I do actually have here a copy, which actually came across my phone, of an article that I wrote in 1994. I was asked to write an article for the Journal of International Education in 1993. It was published in 1994. And it was supposed to be talking about English language proficiency in British education, measuring quality and raising standards. That was what it was called. But I was given the title. And in it, I wrote quite a lot about Malib and as it was by that time, and about the accreditation scheme. The accreditation scheme, I think Andy's representation wasn't actually quite right. I was at the time a British Council inspector. They set up a scheme for inspecting private language schools, and I was one of their inspectors. And they decided, the British Council decided, that there were some awful things going on in British universities, and that they should inspect British universities. And when I passed on this message to other people in Bali, we all agreed that the British Council were not the best people to do it. And so we got together and discussed the possibility of Bali setting up an accreditation scheme and asking the British Council to approve it and to discuss it. And I think I wrote quite a lot of the papers for that proposal, but I don't think I have them anymore. I don't know whether they survived at all. But in this article in 1994, I said, so far, 30 universities have been inspected. Of these, 25 have received accreditation. 2 have failed to receive accreditation, and 3 have been referred for improvements in the course. Of the two failed courses, one has already applied for re-inspection after making improvements in the light of the report. In addition, six universities were inspected this summer for the first time, and the inspectors' reports are currently being considered. And I go on to say, what makes a good course, and what were the problems with the courses that failed or were referred? Which is quite interesting. Someone put in their report that since most students were highly intelligent and well motivated to learn the language which would help them towards academic success, they were therefore unwilling to waste time and money chatting in class, that this was called practicing conversation by the course organisers, that the students were very unhappy at attending a course which seemed to them to be merely a rehash of the type of secondary school language instruction that they had had before, under which they had failed to acquire English. Another problem that was mentioned was that many courses were not resourced properly. There weren't proper books or learning materials, and that students didn't use the university library because the people on the course had not introduced them to using British libraries. And finally, that many staff on this failed course were people who had simply been transferred from a closed classics department to look after the overseas students' language problems. Okay, I'll stop.